It is my very great privilege and delight to introduce Dr. Brian Spinks and to welcome him to the student convocation. Dr. Spinks is the chaplain at the chapel at Churchill College at the University of Cambridge. He is lecturer in liturgy at the Divinity Faculty, University of Cambridge, and dean of studies and lecturer in doctrine and liturgy at the Cambridge Religious Studies Center. His academic career, in a sense, began at the University of Durham, where he received his BA honors in theology in 1970, diploma in theology with distinction in 1971, and then on to King's College, University of London for the Master of Theology, which he did under the doctors Geoffrey Cumming and Ronald Jasper. Some of you, I understand, use their book about Eucharistic prayers in your courses. He studied Syriac with Professor Sebastian Brock and has specialized in East Syrian liturgical tradition. He then applied for the BD at Durham and later the DD, degrees which are considered in Britain to be above even the PhD. He is a member of the Church of England Liturgical Commission and other commissions and consultations which have taken him into a very broad spectrum of liturgical traditions. He has written numerous books on a great variety of subjects with regards to liturgical studies. One that is perhaps most familiar to us, and some of you may have seen over the years, is Luther's Liturgical Criterion is Reform of the Canon of the Mass, a book that has been used at our seminary, our sister seminary, Fort Wayne, and other Lutheran seminaries in North America, for instance, Luther Northwest. It's quite an amazing contribution, a small monograph that has contributed to Lutherans studying their own liturgy and liturgical tradition and theology. He's also contributed to various journals, and his current area of research is Predestination, Covenant, and Sacraments in the Thought of William Perkins. Dr. Spinks is probably one of the top liturgical scholars in the world today, and so it is a very great honor that he has come to share some time with us and to present his paper. I am pleased to welcome now Dr. Spinks.
Can I thank Ron Feuerhahn for his very kind introduction and the very flattering things that he's said about me. It's 5.5 years now since I had the honor and privilege of being here to address you. And I'm most pleased to have that honor and privilege again now. And for that, I really do have to thank Ron Feuerhahn. When Norman Nagel was over in Cambridge, I think 2.5 years ago, he made the suggestion that perhaps you could tolerate Spinks again. But over the last 18 months, Ron has worked extremely hard to put a schedule together for me. And I'm very grateful for all the real hard work that he did for that. And also I must thank him and Carol for hosting myself and my wife. They have been most gracious hosts over not only the period of Easter, to have strangers in their household, but also at a time just before a family wedding with all its traumas. So I want to thank them both very much indeed. The title of this paper is Liturgy and Culture, Is Modern Western Liturgical Revision a Case of Not Seeing the Wood for the Trees? Our faith and worship are not part of the modern secular world in which we live, not part of its socially shared and confirmed reality. As believers and worshippers, we step outside the dominant secular culture as social deviants. This quotation from a paper by Charles Davis, read at a World Council of Churches consultation in 1969, formed one of the passages for discussion in the examination for the Master of Theology in Liturgical Studies of London University in 1972, which I had to sit. The syllabus had been newly created by Geoffrey Cumming and Ronald Jasper, and this formed part of Ronald Jasper's paper on the liturgical movement. Although many subsequent liturgists have judged Ronald Jasper by the somewhat pedestrian and timid rites of the Alternative Service Book 1980 of the Church of England, he was in fact well aware of where progressive liturgical thought was heading. And he knew that what the Church of England would allow him to achieve in terms of a revised liturgy would seem light years behind. Thus, believing that liturgy and culture would be a major growth area in liturgical theology, he included the most recent writings on the subject as a topic of study in his examination syllabus. As he so rightly discerned, the topic is one which has continued to proliferate, one of the most recent examples being the 1989 Congress of Societas Liturgica held at York in the UK with the title The Enculturation of the Liturgy. The idea of the liturgy and the Christian values it articulates interacting with society was, of course, one of the central hopes of the liturgical movement as envisaged by its early exponents, such as Lambert Baudouin, Virgil Michel, and Gabriel Hebert. These ideas also form the basis of Brian Wicker's 1963 book, Culture and Liturgy. But the whole topic was given fresh impetus by the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy of Vatican II, promulgated in the same year as Wicker's book. Among other things, this important document envisaged the revision of the Roman rites to make them more suitable for the 20th century. But in Articles 37 to 40, also outlined norms for adapting the Roman liturgy to the culture and traditions of peoples, an approach which was reinforced by the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World in 1965. This was a different emphasis from the early pioneers of the liturgical movement, for here was not just the hope that the liturgy would interact with and infect society, but the recognition that as a society changes, so will the liturgy celebrated within its midst change. And since societies differ across the world, the liturgy will need to accommodate different cultures. Liturgy was no longer seen as monochrome, but as a variety of cultural colors. Since then, both Catholic and Protestant scholars have penned articles, books, and reports on the subject of liturgy and culture. These tend to fall into five groups. First, general reflections on the context of culture and liturgy, looking at the function of worship in any society. Secondly, concern to adapt Western liturgy to the needs of third world cultures and for those cultures to produce their own liturgical rites. Thirdly, historical studies concerned with examining how liturgies of the past have reflected the culture of their time and geographical place. Fourthly, a concern with the question of how to modernize or enculturate Western liturgy. And fifth, theological reflection and critique of the whole topic. I want now to turn to some basic observations on this literature. And the first is the problems of definition. The first problem that is encountered when reading the literature on this topic is the difficulty of precise definition of terms. The very word culture heads the list. As David Power reminds us, everyone knows what it is, but finds it difficult to define. Power describes it as whatever is expressed in traditions, beliefs, customs, institutions, art and artifacts, symbols, myths, and rites. Its core is the values and the meaning on which human life, individual and collective, is based. Hugh Montefiore, in a recent collection of essays published in the United Kingdom, describes it thus. It forms the background of the lives of people who live in a country and is compounded of its dominant religion, or lack of it, its ethics and ideology, its literature and art, its science and technology, its philosophical and ethical traditions, and its ethos and way of life. Among the most important of its ingredients are the unconscious assumptions which underlie the thinking of a society and by which its members live their lives. These are the root paradigms or set assumptions about the fundamental nature of the universe, humankind, or the way in which people behave, which are so deeply held by the members of a society as to be essentially unquestioned by them. Culture thus covers so many facets of human life and thought as to become almost unmanageable. In addition, each country and ethnic group has its own distinctive culture and/or subcultures. African culture or Latin American culture consists of very different subcultures, as indeed does European culture. The picture is made even more complex by the fact that in the global village, the modern culture prevalent in Western Europe and North America, with its stress on technology, impinges on nearly all other cultures. There is also confusion over the terminology used by liturgists. Indigenization was the word preferred by many Protestant writers on liturgy, whereas Catholics opted for adaptation and then inculturation. American writers tend to speak of contextualization of worship. Jeffrey Wainwright once urged localization. J.S. Poby, looking at a specifically African setting, preferred the term skenosis or tenting to indicate that authentic liturgy should be incarnational. In his 1982 book, Cultural Adaptation of the Liturgy, Ansgar Chupunko differentiated between acculturation of liturgy, which he described as the adaptation of the Roman rite, and inculturation of the liturgy, which takes pre-Christian rites and endows them with Christian meaning. Yet in his later book, Liturgies of the Future, published in 1989, he speaks of adaptation, or updating the liturgy, acculturation, or interacting with other cultures, inculturation, or sharing the hopes, laws, and ritual patterns of a culture, and creativity, where new liturgical texts are composed independently of the traditional structure, in his case of the Roman liturgy. There is thus no agreed or common terminology between writers, and there's even a shift one can find in a particular writer. The other thing is the benefit of hindsight. Those studies which are concerned with liturgies and cultures of the past usually yield concrete examples of inculturation or creativity. Perhaps one of the earliest and quite unintentional ventures into this area was Edmund Bishop's celebrated paper, The Genius of the Roman Rite, where the simplicity of the Roman prayers was contrasted with the more exuberant form of the Gallican and Mozarabic rite, illustrating, I quote, a style, a run of thought, and a mode of expression so clearly different as to declare the two things to be the product of the mind, spirit, and genius of two different peoples. It is equally possible to pick out the Semitic flavor of the East Syrian anaphora of Adai and Mari. I had to get that in somewhere. Where the expression, you put on our humanity, far from being Nestorian, as William Bright feared, reflects the ancient Syriac manner of describing the incarnation. In Cultural Adaptation of the Liturgy, one of the best chapters is the historical section, where Chupunko looks at the apostolic period with its Christological qualifications of Judaism and Hellenism. Later, there is the adaptation in the age of persecution, where, among other features, is the Church's first attempt to express the apostolic tradition in the language and rituals of a pagan culture, the Greco-Roman culture. Another division he makes is from the Edict of Milan to the 7th century, when honor dignatus and gradus creep into the ordination prayers, and the pagan cults become the storehouse for the Church's rites. Indeed, some of the sacrificial language of the Canon of the Mass is taken from obsolete pagan cultic terminology, enculturated and pressed into Christian usage. Similarly, in the Te Igitur, language used to address the imperial majesty is now addressed to the Lord of Heaven. From the 8th century to the Baroque age, the Roman ritual yielded to the pressure of the Franco-Germanic cultures. Medieval drama intruded, and then Baroque theatre. The Enlightenment also makes its mark in the period up to the liturgical movement. Slightly different historical paradigms or divisions were used in a recent article by Martinet, the Judeo-Christian to the Hellenistic paradigm, from the Hellenistic to the Greco-Roman and Byzantine paradigm, from the Greco-Roman to the medieval Roman Catholic paradigm, from the medieval to the modern evangelical Protestant paradigm, and finally the Second Vatican Council paradigm and beyond. In the second paradigm, for example, he is able to point to altars, incense, candles, garlands, litanic prayer, oaths and salutations, rank, honors, and vestments of the imperial court, artistic motifs and symbols being adapted with some new meaning and symbolism. Again, one of the most concrete papers at the 1989 Societas Liturgica Congress was Pierre Gilles's historical paper on enculturation in the West. Gilles was able to illustrate how the Latin liturgy borrowed words from Greek and Hebrew and also altered the sense of certain Latin words, giving them a completely new meaning to their hitherto common meaning. Oratio, meaning ordinary speech, was adopted for Christian prayer rather than the pagan religious word preces. The feasts of the Church, even if computed, as Talley has argued, may also have been instituted in opposition to pagan feasts and represent enculturation through conflict. The next thing that emerges from this vast amount of literature is sharp focus on non-Western enculturation. The most obvious paradigms for discussing the progress and success or otherwise of enculturation of liturgy seem to be those developed in and for third world cultures, or at least non-European and North American cultures. India, for example, the process of enculturation was pioneered by the Roman Catholic National Biblical Catechetical and Liturgical Center at Bangalore. With the new orders of the Mass for India finalized in 1973 and published for limited use in 1974. This introduced enculturation in the form of ceremonial and texts. At the level of ceremonial, Indian-style gestures were introduced, semi-prostrations instead of genuflections, squatting instead of kneeling, oil lamps instead of candles, and floral tributes, jostics, and arti lamps as used at puja. In terms of texts, provision was made for the reading of Hindu scriptures, and a Eucharistic prayer was composed using concepts and language drawn from the ancient Hindu philosophies, but also in one particular stanza from other Indian religious traditions, particularly Sikhism, Buddhism, and Islam. Now, this was certainly Indian and a brave attempt to de-Westernize or Indianize the Eucharistic liturgy. The texts were, however, open to considerable theological objections, and the Sacred Congregation for Divine Worship and the Sacraments declined to give permission for non-biblical readings or for the Indian Eucharistic prayer. Another criticism which has been made of this rite was its exclusive ethos. Much of the language, especially of the Eucharistic prayer, with its echoes of Sanskrit concepts, was too elitist for the less educated and lower caste Indians. In the 1980s, the United Theological College of Bangalore, under the chairmanship of Dr. Eric Lott, began to develop the Indian Protestant interest in enculturation. A Eucharistic liturgy for the Church of South India has been published, and it has been adapted by the Church of North India. Virginia Kennelly describes it thus: specifically Indian motives include the chant of a Saranam, song of refuge sought in God under various attributes, both at the lamp lighting preceding the confession and as an alternative to the sanctus, the use of the asato in the awakening litany preceding the readings, provision for a reading from an Indian scripture on special occasions, the idea of God as greater than all names and forms, our inmost self, in the newly drafted affirmations of faith at the close of the liturgy of the word, the namajapa, or recital of the names of Christ in an Indian language while the table altar is prepared before the institution narrative, the prayer for dashana, awareness of Christ's presence, before the sharing of the bread and wine. There are also fewer Sanskrit or Vedic words, and so this liturgy appears less elitist than the Catholic attempt. In an African context, various suggestions have been made for incorporating ceremonies or customs which are deep-seated in African cultures into Christian liturgy. For example, the Jando ceremony, circumcision connected with puberty as part of Christian initiation. A mass for Zaire, which the Pope declined to use when he visited Zaire, was completed in 1972 and attempted to combine liturgical antiquity with the religious and cultural heritage of Zaire. The result is an example of Chupunco's category of adaptation. Raymond Maloney has summarized this rite thus: the Zairean Mass is basically the Roman rite, but it has introduced a number of changes which help to give it a character of its own. These changes are mainly four. One, the invocation of the saints and ancestors at the beginning of the Mass. Two, the relocation of the rite of penance, together with the sign of peace, to a position after the Gospel and Creed and before the bidding prayers. Three, the reorganization of the presentation of gifts. And four, a modified version of the Eucharistic prayer based on the second of the four in the Roman Missal. Indeed, the Eucharistic prayer describes God as the sun too bright for our gaze, and thanksgiving is included for our river the Zaire, our forests, our rivers, our lakes. The Anglican Church in Kenya had for many years used the 1662 Book of Common Prayer, but its new rite draws upon material from African traditional religion. Philip Tovey notes of this rite that in the intercessions a litany is developed that is based on a Kikuyu litany, and the final blessing is also based upon a Turkana blessing. At a more general level, J.S. Poby suggested use of not only African music, but regional African association of color for vestments. For example, gold or yellow are festive, but red is a sign of death. And that perhaps the language of the royal courts of African tribes would be worth serious study for forms of addressing God. These examples from India and Africa can be discussed and assessed because they contrast with traditional Western forms, and the differences can be kept in sharp focus. The non-Christian religious traditions of these countries are living religions, and they form a useful, identifiable conceptual background. It is possible to see where they have suggested a counterpart in an enculturated Christian rite, or where their influence has crossed a threshold to verge upon syncretism. In some unofficial rites and ceremonies, especially of fringe churches, syncretism is obvious, and the Christian rite has been absorbed by some local religion, such as in some African messianism movements and Haiti voodoo rites. The contrast and perspective allows this sharp focus. But in observing all this literature, I detect a certain impasse when liturgists turn to discuss modern culture and modern liturgical revision in the West. Usually there is considerable discussion on what constitutes Western culture as it has developed since the Enlightenment. The recent symposium edited by Montefiore provides a good analysis, but there is far from agreement among the contributors. The Enlightenment has, for example, produced a particular idea of history. I quote, a system closed by the parameters of data, positivist in being preoccupied with archivally substantiated fact, dominated by the rational criteria for analysis, occupied with limited problems, and concerned to establish cause and effect in as concrete a fashion as is possible. It is a culture which believes in material progress, which is achieved by high technology. Science is regarded by many as autonomous and is perceived as knowledge conceived as simply exact information about the physical world, acquired professionally by experts using experimental methods. It is frequently described as pluralistic, though Colin Gunton challenges this, suggesting that there is a leveling down achieved by the mass media and mass production. The mass media is indeed a powerful influence, since it expresses, circulates, and popularizes underlying cultural assumptions and attitudes. However, according to Jim McDonnell, the result of competing media allows and creates a fragmentation of corporate experience as subcultures proliferate. It is recognized as a secular society, though not a priori hostile to religion. However, each religious claim is regarded on its merits and its usefulness. Within this post-Enlightenment culture, and with the appearance of the new missal of Paul VI, Hermann Schmidt was able to ask, have we really succeeded in giving the new liturgy that cultural content and structure which should make, pastorally speaking, an impact on the modern world? And Charles Davis claimed that the general verdict upon liturgical reform is that it has failed to solve the problem of worship in a secular age. Unlike studies on Indian or African liturgies, those dealing with Western culture and modern Western liturgical revision seem unable to discuss the new ceremonies and texts within a cultural context. For example, the papers on worship and secularization published in 1970 and 1971 never actually discuss concrete liturgical reforms. M. Francis Mannion, in an excellent article in 1988 entitled Liturgy and the Present Crisis of Culture, only refers in broad terms to the liturgies of Vatican II. At the 1989 Societas Liturgica Congress, William Crockett spoke on the title Christianity and Culture in Modern Secular Society, rather than on Liturgy and Culture in Modern Secular Society, and managed to avoid speaking specifically about any liturgical rite whatsoever. In his presidential address to the Congress, Donald Gray urged that if it was to yield any solutions, then it was liturgy which must be considered, and not religion in general. His words largely fell on deaf ears, mainly because those people had prepared their papers before they heard his. And yet, his address assumed that there was a problem or problems, and that solutions were needed. From the literature, one senses that there is an acceptance that there is a problem, that modern Western liturgies are at variance with modern Western culture, and that at the moment they are acultural, with inculturation a distant goal or pious hope. Part of the problem is the difficulty of looking at one's own culture and liturgy from within, since it lacks perspective. The problem seems to be that we cannot see the wood for the trees. In a final withering paper at the 1989 Societas Liturgica Congress on the subject of inculturation, Professor Aidan Kavanagh of Yale called in question the whole enterprise. Whatever is supposed to be conveyed by enculturation, so he argued, has always happened and continues to happen with or without conscious reflection or conferences on the topic. The inference is that liturgies are themselves a product and part of the complexity which makes up culture, including Western culture. Indeed, it is difficult to see how they could be otherwise. Perhaps stating the obvious, Charles Davis also wrote, "The individual comes to be a person only in and through the action of the social environment upon him. From infancy onwards, by socialization, he internalizes the social reality that surrounds him. That social reality is drawn into his consciousness and is built into him as the structure of his inner life. His thought and imagination, his emotions and activity are ordered into a pattern given by the culture in which he has been formed, and he depends upon society for the continuance of his attitudes and activity, which otherwise would disintegrate and become meaningless." Those who drew up and revised the liturgies of the latter part of the 20th century were and are themselves products of Western culture. They were educated within it and have absorbed its ethos, even if this is tempered and critiqued by their religious beliefs. The experts of the Concilium, or of the Episcopal Church's Standing Liturgical Commission, or of the Church of England's Liturgical Commission, are products of the culture, many of them schooled in its best universities. Methods of revision were scholarly and scientific as taught in the academy. The first drafts were circulated for discussion and were experimented with and revised in the light of experience and fresh expert advice, be it pastoral, educational, or theological agencies. They were subject to pressure groups and some financial restraint. The final products were typeset using modern printing methods and design. Celebration of the new liturgies have been filmed and reviewed on video. Ulrich Simon, reviewing the Church of England's draft Series 3 Communion Rite in 1971, wrote, "The sociologist will certainly identify this work with the generation from which it springs and which it serves. Here is the liturgy of the Western middle class, full of good intentions, decent, and just a little dull. 1971 must be reckoned to be petty bourgeois to the point of nausea." Simon's concern was with what he regarded as the surrender of protest and eschatology in the liturgy, and is not without validity. However, it would be hard for 1971 not to be identified with the generation from which it sprang, be it the decent middle class or hippie protest, unless it really was a totally acultural work. But no liturgy is. Without necessarily being as negative as Simon, it is possible to observe a whole number of characteristics of modern Western liturgies which show deference to their cultural milieu. First, change in political and theological thought. The Church of England liturgies of 1552-1662 have enshrined within them the Tudor concept of monarchy and government, and a particular view of God's providence. The American Prayer Book of 1789 had to alter the political dimension to suit a republic, which in turn underwent temporary alteration at the hands of Bishop Polk in January 1861, when the state of Louisiana withdrew from the Union, and again in the February when it joined the Confederacy. Similarly, the 1980 Alternative Service Book Rite A no longer promotes the royal supremacy. Her Majesty is still prayed for, bless and guide, but English Anglicans no longer ask that under her the nation may be godly and quietly governed in the Tudor understanding of those words. Prayer for justice and peace replaces prayer for justice and punishment, and the common good replaces maintain thy true, that is the established, religion and virtue. The changes befit a democratic nation and a pluralist society. Second, God and social justice. David Holton has drawn attention to the concern for social justice in the new Anglican-Canadian liturgy. He cites the old 1662 Collect for the Holy Innocents, with its spiritualizing of the deaths of the children, as lacking any reality of the slaughter of babies or any appeal to God's righteous justice. It should not be surprising, he writes, to find that Christians living in a post-Holocaust, post-Ethiopian world have difficulty in praying this prayer. The new rite has, "Merciful God, accept all we offer you this day. Preserve your people from cruelty and indifference to violence, that the weak may always be defended from the tyranny of the strong." Thirdly, social awareness. Here we may cite the concern for anti-Semitism in the toning down of the references to the Jews, for example, in the Good Friday Collects in the Roman Rite and the Lent Holy Week and Easter services of the Church of England. Another concern which emerged out of the feminist movement of the 1960s was the criticism of the male-orientated nature of the English language. And clearly this concern is reflected in the 1979 American Episcopal Prayer Book. The marriage service of the Alternative Service Book recognizes the mutuality of marriage and the provision for the exchange of rings, an example of liturgy catching up with changing customs. The exhortation, the same service, also reflects the higher evaluation of sexual intercourse and has abandoned the suspicion of sex found in the 1662 rite. The new Roman funeral rite allows for the traditional five-stage rite, where it is still practical, but assumes that in urban areas with modern funerary customs and transport, a three-stage rite will be the norm: vigil in the home, mass with commendation and farewell, and a burial or cremation. The processions with prayers to and from the church are simply not practical in modern urban settings. Fourth, informality. Traditional Eucharistic ceremonial reflects 4th and 5th century imperial court ceremonial. But from the 1960s, Western culture has seen a trend towards informality. In England, for example, school teachers abandoned wearing academic gowns, as did the older universities for their undergraduate students' dress. BBC announcers abandoned dinner jackets or evening dress, and the BBC English was joined by regional accents. A similar relaxation of presidency of service took place in church. The ceremonial was simplified. In many places, the celebrant faced west. The language became less formal. It is perhaps no accident that many celebrants, especially in evangelical churches, have modeled themselves loosely on the television chat show host, greeting the audience, warming them up, and introducing and explaining various parts of the entertainment. Choice. One characteristic of modern Western society is its pluralism and individual choice, with market forces determining the survival of the fittest. Not only are people offered the traditional denominational differences within Christianity, but even denominations offer different styles of worship: folk or choral music, modern English, Tudor English, Latin, as well as formal and informal or family worship. Subcultures. The pluralism of modern culture means that suppliers feed the markets of subcultures, be it pop cults, sport, the arts, and so on. Liturgy in the past has been mainly concerned with the whole church, where all are one in Christ, and theoretically at least, without concern for wealth, status or age. A modern phenomenon has been the growth of special services for special groups. Family services are particularly popular in English middle-class suburbia. But there are even feminist liturgies, as well as, for an even more specialized market, gay and lesbian liturgies, the latter reflecting the Western concern for individual human rights, sometimes, so it is argued, against the interests of the rights of society. Whether such concern for special groups engenders Catholicity is another question, but it is certainly a reflection of Western culture. And syncretism. The old religions of Europe are dead, but the West has managed to provide its own examples of liturgies where the cultural concern for novelty, entertainment, and self-expression has become the prime criterion. A service in an American college was described by John Killinger. I don't think it refers to the chapel here. The reader read, "An Ortmayer blew up balloons and let them sail around the chapel as the air rushed out. Helpers in the balcony sail paper plates over the heads of the people below." It's not Churchill College Chapel either. "Each plate had a news clipping on it with instructions for the person catching it to stand and read it aloud. whatever else was going on. Some persons were throwing paper streamers, others were wrapping themselves or their neighbours in them. Here is a Western counterpart to the vaguely Christian voodoo rites of Haiti. Killinger's book was entitled Leave It to the Spirit, but the spirit in question is the zeitgeist or too much gin. No doubt other examples could be added, but these are sufficient to illustrate the truth of Kavanagh's assertion that enculturation happens without having to agonize over it. Western liturgies need to accept that their liturgies do reflect and engage with their Western cultural context, even if the Eucharistic prayers do not specifically give thanks to the River Tiber or the Thames or the Hudson. In his classic work of Christ and Culture, Richard Niebuhr outlined five approaches or characteristics: Christ of culture, Christ against culture, Christ above culture, Christ and culture in paradox, and Christ and the transformation of culture. Of these, three seem to me to be important ingredients for assessing a balanced liturgy, though my interpretation of them is not necessarily that which perhaps Niebuhr intended. First, Christ of culture. Central to Christianity is the belief that in Christ God took human flesh. The incarnation confirms the creation as God's deliberate act and its intrinsic goodness. God is the God of culture, and the work of human hands is always offered God in thanksgiving. In the incarnation, God affirms human societies and cultures. Liturgy needs to affirm those things in human culture which are in harmony with the gospel. By itself, however, this can lead to syncretism. And therefore, we need Christ against culture. God in Christ also judges the world and convicts it of sin. The incarnation is inextricably bound up with the atonement and resurrection and the eschaton. This world is passing away. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. There are many human activities which are in contradiction to the gospel and will be challenged and condemned in the liturgy: racism, persecution, atheism, indifference, and greed, for example. Christ against culture is a safeguard, or should be, against syncretism. And thirdly, Christ the transformer of culture. The gospel is to be proclaimed in the world and forgiveness declared, God's amnesty. The result is not total destruction of human culture, but transformation and redemption. For example, in Islamic countries, Christian liturgy, where tolerated, since Eastern culture does not always share the West's idea of toleration, will be seen to challenge the fatalistic predestination which Islam seems to imply. Now, with the conviction that modern Western liturgies do reflect interaction with modern Western culture, in the final part of this paper, I want to focus on two recent liturgical compilations of the Church of England with which I have been involved: Patterns for Worship, a draft report of 1989, and The Promise of His Glory, Services from All Saints to Candlemas, published in 1991, and to look at these with the three categories borrowed from Niebuhr in mind. Patterns for Worship, not all of which has been yet authorized for use, was completed to meet three needs: to demonstrate the flexibility of the alternative service book by giving alternative forms for use where the rubrics allow such. Secondly, to provide forms for use at the family service, which are often homespun liturgies, replacing the official statutory rites, quite illegally. Thirdly, to provide for places designated as urban priority areas, working-class urban areas where bookish culture is alien. The Daily Telegraph standard of language of the alternative service book was not considered user-friendly for this particular social grouping. Some of us who perhaps wouldn't be in that group also find it not very user-friendly. Guidelines for the language for the new prayers included the use of concrete visual images rather than language which is conceptual and full of ideas, the avoidance of Latin-style constructions with dependent clauses, and avoiding stark and empty language. Two of the stated purposes of Patterns for Worship are cultural and social. The family service in the Church of England has a history reaching back beyond the provision of a third service in 1872 to be celebrated in addition to the statutory services. In some parishes, it has become the main service of a Sunday, replacing the statutory liturgy. In others, it is perhaps once a month. These services tend to be informal, involve children, drama, sometimes non-biblical readings, and a talk as opposed to non-user-friendly sermon. Sometimes these services are aimed exclusively at children, though many middle-class suburbians in England seem to cling to a childlike faith, which doesn't make too many demands on the intellect. Sometimes the homespun prayers, although from the heart and sincere, are neither good theology nor good English. In some of them, there is a tendency to speak of wrong or false rather than sin, a move away from theological categories to a human error. Some confessions simply say sorry rather than express repentance. Patterns for Worship provides liturgical forms for this socio-economic group, recognizing the need for such services, but it attempts to rein in the wilder excesses and give stronger and more varied forms of confession. Thus, Lord God, we have done evil in your sight. We have sinned against you alone. Lord our God, we have sinned and avoided your call. There is also a tendency in Patterns Worship to concern itself with the family of humanity and the church, rather than with the modern nuclear family with its 2.3 children. In both these examples, we have expressions of the Christ of culture and against culture, affirming, providing for, but challenging. The collection was also intended for another socio-economic group whose drab surroundings and prospects of employment often contrast considerably with the middle-class suburban congregations. Francis Mannion has argued that given the importance of images and metaphors in shaping and orienting faith, the image of the church as city seems more adequate than the images of family or community of friends. And perhaps this has not been exploited sufficiently, but nevertheless, there is material for confession, intercession, post-communion, and proper prefaces for the city, as well as concern for mercy and justice. God is addressed as God of glory, God of compassion, God of truth, God of power. One of the proposed Eucharistic prayers prays, Lord God of justice and mercy, you care for the world and for every child of your creation. We glorify your name. You call us to share your life and you give us your love. You are our Father, kind and compassionate, always ready to forgive. You rejoice in our joy, listen patiently to our troubles, and comfort us in distress. Another Eucharistic prayer prays in the Anamnesis, Father, we plead with confidence his sacrifice made once for all upon the cross. Here is a specific example of transformation of language. This is not the pleading with fear before the local magistrate, nor the pleading of desperation and anger in front of the social security officials, nor the plead of old federal theology. But like some of those Latin terms cited by G, it is pressed into new use, pleading with confidence in anticipation of receiving forgiveness and benefit from a caring and compassionate God who gives us these gifts. There are other hints of cultural influence. Compared with the 1970s, there is far more confidence in religion concerning creation and science, the Big Bang and cosmic ripples being not incompatible with a creatio ex nihilo theology. Patterns for Worship provides thanksgivings and intercessions on the theme of creation, reflecting this confidence, as well as present Western environmental concern, which often, of course, only the West can afford. There is also concern for social justice. What we have here is both affirmation of modern Western culture, but also some theological transformation of middle-class and urban priority area perceptions. The promise of his glory was aimed at the church as a whole and provides a rich fare of traditional services and ceremonies and new ones. There are indications of these services affirming culture or protesting against it with transformation as a goal. Christmas and some of the ancient pre-Christian symbols have become deeply embedded in English culture. This folk religion is reflected in this book in the provision for the Advent wreath, the blessing of the crib, carol services, the Jesse Tree, and the candlelit services, as well as the popular newcomer to the English scene, the Christingle service. At the same time, there is a deliberate compromise with a secular Christmas, which destroys the Western four-week Advent and ends abruptly on the 26th of December. Since Advent was not always 4 weeks, the eschatological theme now begins 6 weeks before Christmas, with the two Sundays before Christmas being given over to the theme of Annunciation. This restores the integrity of Advent and at the same time gives a smoother transition from Advent to Christmas. The commentary explains, much of Advent, the season of watching and waiting, has been engulfed by the anticipation of Christmas, and in recent years it has seemed a little like a clerical killjoy frowning at society. To make the kingship of Christ the focus of Sundays before Advent links the theme of his universal kingdom with the more nationalistic commemorations of Remembrancetide and provides for Advent a more resonant context than simply preparing for Christmas. So Advent can now stand out more clearly by challenging and at the same time as valuing the world Christ came to judge and save. In England, Epiphany is not a public holiday, and the commemoration following the traditional Western concern has been about the visit of the Magi. The importance of the festival in the East, with its associations with the baptism of Christ and the wedding at Cana of Galilee, has been the basis of a fairly lavish service celebrating Epiphany, with plenty of use of symbols. In this case, the Commission has tried to promote Christ against culture with the hope of transformation and the rediscovery in England of Epiphany as an important festival. In contrast with the Church of England tradition from 1549 onwards, the promise of his glory makes considerable provision for observing All Saints and All Souls. Although some naive evangelical critics have seen this as creeping Romanism, it is rather to be seen as a Christian response to the growing Western fear of death and dying, and to the more fanciful concern with Halloween and a hideous, malevolent afterlife. Lastly, the increased use of symbolism in these services may also represent an unconscious response to the observation of anthropologists that Western culture is beginning to value and use symbolism, which it once freely jettisoned as outdated for modern man. The service for light for vigils, the Advent wreath, the Epiphany symbols, and candles for Candlemas come into this category. It is my contention, therefore, that the crisis Western liturgists allege exists in the modern liturgies is more a problem of perspective than failure to interact with culture. If anything, the problem is to guard against the modern liturgies being just a religious gloss on a developing Western culture. Modern Western rites cannot but help reflect the culture from which they spring, either in affirming the culture or in challenging it, and or in working for its transformation. If there is a crisis, the fault is probably not that the liturgies are not modern, but possibly because in affirming culture, they have obscured the mystery and transcendence of God, which comes as an outsider to all human cultures. But of course, it is possible that the fault also lies elsewhere, with preaching, mission, pastoralia, and public stance. The liturgy cannot be the whole missionary activity of the modern Western Church, nor can it be the scapegoat for all other ecclesiastical shortcomings. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your presentation. I'd like to ask you a question about whether you see any timeless aspects in the liturgy that would be in contradiction with certain liturgical enculturations of liturgy today. You certainly gave some good examples of perhaps homosexual liturgy or feminist liturgies that might be in contradiction to aspects of what we might see as timeless aspects of liturgy. But what about things that might be more subtle, that that might creep in and we might see as okay, but in actuality might actually contradict what could be a timeless aspect, a biblical aspect of liturgy?
Yeah. First of all, of course there is a timeless aspect of liturgy. It is that part of liturgy which comes from without, the God-given parts, which are not negotiable, and which either affirm or challenge or transform our human culture. But in every age, in every generation, the liturgy must be brought back to be critiqued and brought under the gospel. It cannot stand aside from it. Now, I cite feminist liturgies. I mean, the whole thing worries me, and that it challenges ecclesiology and Catholicity, and it is a symptom of Western liturgy. And perhaps if I was in some seminaries and said it, I'd be hauled out and never seen again. But I think it is syncretism which should firmly be resisted. Particularly where the feminist liturgies, for example, I know I'm safe ground here, I will survive, I think, but where, you know, it starts tampering with language about the deity. I'm prepared to pray for all people rather than all men. That doesn't worry me, but when I start being told that I must not pray Our Father, then, you know, here I stand. But, yes, but the part of the problem is that because we are products of a culture and cannot be anything else, that's part of our inheritance of creation, it is sometimes a subsequent generation which can only look back and say that. I mean, I can make cheap comments and rude comments about the ASB or Series 3. Firstly, I wasn't involved in the compilation, so it's sort of no skin off my nose. But no doubt, even now, there are probably younger liturgists in England saying, "How we can see stupid old Spinks putting his ideas in this one, you know, because he was involved in it, and, you know, he's a bit getting over the hill now." And I can see, you know, what we've produced will be identified as the late 80s and 90s, responding to things that were important in England then. So, yeah, in every generation and subsequent generation, the liturgy has to be hauled back to the gospel and brought under its judgment. And we will then see what was simply a passing fad, fashion, which has to be got rid of. Or in Luther's words, whoever takes offense, you know, no matter who takes offense.
I also thank you very much for your presentation. And I wondered if you would care to comment, you might not, on what I think is also a difficult problem in the encounter between liturgy and culture, and that is, your presentation focused upon the words of texts, and I'm thinking also that words are combined with music and musical style. And I think it probably would be fair to say that in our circles in this country, that's a real difficult issue, and one doesn't often hear reasonable voices discussing it. And since you seemed eminently reasonable, I thought I'd ask. Ask if you would just reflect on
yes.
You know, the emotional quality of music is such a powerful force, and it's a real factor. So,
yes. First, can I say you're absolutely right. Liturgy is more than texts, and if I have appeared to be textual, that reflects the culture and church from which I come, where a liturgical commission is purely concerned with texts, not with music, and in theory, not even doctrine, though some of us make sure that isn't quite right. So we are preoccupied with texts in the Church of England. But yes, liturgy is something which, if it's the right term, performed. It is not one person reading texts, it's an interaction of the people of God gathered for worship, in which they pray, proclaim, and they use music to the praise and glory of God. One of the problems is, I think musicians have a problem, particularly in setting text to music, because the texts now are disposable. You know, we throw them away with everything else. And people are not going to develop good, really good music, or there'll be fewer or much less good music developed in a short space of time than in the older texts, which, you know, had more stability. Music is important, and perhaps we aren't working hard enough at it. So much of modern ecclesiastical music in England comes from more conservative evangelical churches and is quite frankly banal and almost insulting and embarrassing. I bored some people with this already, but some of you I'll bore now, that I was actually sent out by the Bishop of Ely to observe something called the Thomas Mass, which is something developed in the Finnish church, the Lutheran church in Finland, to bring back urban dwellers. And I was really moved by this service, which is a very, very subtle blending of traditional, formal, high church liturgy with some more colloquial or from the heart pieces to balance, supplement it, using modern instruments. They have, in this particular church, the Agricola Church in Helsinki, they have a beautiful organ, which they don't use for this service. It's piano, violin, clarinet, drums. But the music was good music. It was using traditional Finnish melodies, music from their mission field in Africa, Taizé music, but all carefully written and set particularly for this service. It was good, and there was an extremely good choir. Now, if that sort of thing can be achieved, then, yeah, this is both affirming culture and using it to transform and challenge. I fear that in England, we just have nothing like that. It's either the older traditional music or this banal music with guitars.
Dr. Spinks, do you think that it is reasonable or maybe desirable to move towards a type of liturgy that is really not bound by a specific culture? Or is this possible?
You mean an acultural liturgy or...?
Something that's not maybe bound to maybe one culture, but perhaps speaks to, can we say, all people?
I have to say I'm not absolutely sure what you mean. Do you mean, is it possible for the church is to produce a liturgy which could be durable anywhere, or are you asking if there should be a common core in all places?
I'm not really sure myself.
I think given the fact there are God-given things, non-negotiable things in liturgy, then there must always be a common core if it is to be Christian liturgy. But because we are bound by a culture, there are certain things that we use which will make us affirm us and make us feel at home in the presence of God, but which people from another culture will feel alien. One hopes that one can recognize in the liturgy the common core, so one is always encountering the divine and the gospel and not someone else's culture. One would hope in any liturgy that would come through. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I mean, I think this is what the Roman Catholics mean when they talk about adaptation, that you take the basis of the Roman rite, and a certain thing will be found in all Roman Catholic churches, wherever they are, but there will be certain elements which you will only find in this country or this culture.
Thank you.
I thank you also. I have a question, though you may be reiterating if I didn't catch it. How much can a pastor, say, in a setting of the church, educate his congregation members on what the meaning of certain parts of the liturgy are, and how much can that counter or transform the culture? Can that be a means of maintaining one liturgy through so many different cultures? Can education take a part in doing that?
Yes, of course education can. I think the very last sentence I said that, it isn't simply the liturgy on its own. The liturgy is part and parcel of a much greater work and task that the church should have. The tendency is, it may not be for you, but in England, that if anything appears to be not working, then people blame the liturgy. For heaven's sake. I'm sorry, it may be a poor answer to what you wanted, but Liturgy only works if it's supported by other things, I think.
Can we transform, actually, should we try to transform a culture by education, I'm saying, in the church?
Well, obviously, it depends what you mean transform, but in terms of not destroying totally a culture, but affirming what is good and not contradicting the gospel and encouraging it to develop, yes. But I think in some cultures, there may be direct confrontation. Yes.
I'd like to ask one brief question. You've talked about kind of adapting to the culture as one of the problems I've had as a pastor is that as the time goes on, our culture changes so quickly. And I find that you can reach people for a certain time, but as time goes on, those people themselves change. But some people haven't changed, and some people are looking for continuity. And you've got all kinds of different things going on in the congregation. Trying to be sensitive to where a culture is at a certain time can also work against you at a certain point, because you start to trivialize the church, I think would be the way to put it. At some point people say, well, the church was like that before, now it's something different again, and where's the stability, where's the transcultural or the overcultural kind of dimension, or the God culture that stands above culture, our culture, that says something about permanency?
Well, yes.
How do you work that into your project or your sensitivity to culture?
Right. Well, my point is that, yes, there is something above culture or God culture. And I think what I'm saying is we should not be too concerned to diagnose what's happening at the moment in culture, because it happens anyway without having to agonize. You know, we're part of it. We will see some of these concerns. I think we need to get worried when we're running around with this week's latest fashion and trying to somehow make a liturgy for it. You know, it's time to go home then. It really is. It's perhaps difficult for a pastor, because as you say, some people stay with things which are obviously past and out of fashion, where other groups are into the latest new thing and wanting to somehow affirm or have this expressed in liturgy. And I think a pastor just has to be patient and moderate in all things. But the last thing I think we lose if we are deliberately running around trying to enculturate things. It happens automatically without us having to worry about it. And when we start being too conscious of it, that's when I think we step over in syncretism. I don't know, but I just hope and pray that, you know, in 50 years' time, there will be people looking back and saying, what were these stupid people doing authoring feminist liturgies? And you know, I hope so. It will be seen as some ridiculous thing which encroached on the church, and perhaps some theologians who'd run out of ideas seized on to, you know, get a new book out of or something.
Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to have you here.